pigs are going to be the model for that. There's a lot of good news for regenerative medicine. Pigs, great model for eye diseases. If you're studying cardiovascular disease, you know, that's something where the pig really excels. This is a partial list of all the genetic modifications that we've made here at the University of Missouri. I'm going to focus in on disease resistance. But if you guys have any questions about any others, the cystic fibrosis is a really neat story because the pig is the preferred model for cystic fibrosis because you take the mutation that occurs in people and put it in mice, they don't get any symptoms. Also, we've made pigs that make their own omega-3s with this FAT1 gene. So they take omega-6s and convert them to omega-3s. It's a transgene. So if you can see down the list, we've made a lot of pigs for other things. We've got a semen transplantation down here at the bottom. That's something that we spent quite a bit of time on. But that's not to say that's all we can do. There's a whole bunch of others that are in the queue right now. And actually, I need to move this crater really soon because I think we have it done. We're actually over 55 now, and we've got over 1,150 clone pigs. So to put this all in context, you know, we start with the sequenced genome. We then take that information and say, okay, we want to build a model that will replicate what happens in people. So let's find out what happens in people. Let's look what happens in the genome of the pig. Let's compare that to the rodent models that were already out there. And then from that, we can do genetic engineering. Is that CRISPR? Is that something we inject into the zygote and then do embryo transfer? Is that something that we do, in a culture dish and we make a cell that has that genetic modification? We follow that up with somatic cell nuclear transfer that to the pig, get a pig basically from that cell up here that we made that genetic modification. The take-home message is DNA makes RNA makes protein. Okay, if we alter the sequence of DNA, that's going to alter the sequence of RNA, that's going to alter the sequence of the amino acids and the protein. So I want you to think about the cell as a factory. Okay, you've got all these parts in that factory. And let's take one part, a hammer. So you have a hammer, it's got two parts, a handle. With genetic engineering and changing the blueprints, we can tell that factory to make the handle bigger around, skinnier, longer, shorter, curved. Whatever shape you can imagine is compatible with biology, we can change it. Now when you look at the hammer, if I was studying the hammer and I published it, I discovered it, and I published it, it can drive nails. And Bob Weber's over there at Kansas State, he's studying, and he says, oh, I found it can pull nails. So here we have a protein that does two exact opposite different things. Well, what if I want to make it drive nails better? Maybe I'll make the head bigger. Maybe I'll make it smaller. Maybe I'll make the claws longer. Maybe I'll make them shorter. As long as the handle fits in the head and it does its job, we can change the three-dimensional structure of this protein. Be anything we want. Okay, I want you to think about that factory now because the cell is a self-replicating factory. Not only does it make the parts to make the structure of the factory, but it makes the parts to make the structure of the machines that make the parts. Okay, let that sink in for a minute because it also makes the tools that make the parts, that make the tools, that make the machines, that make the factory. It's self-replicating. It pulls in inputs from other places, energy, and the factory to be raw materials, and it converts it into a new factory. And on this factory, I have a molecule sticking out here on the cell surface as kind of a flag, as a CD163. We're going to talk about that one a little bit later in greater detail. So once you understand this concept that really the blueprints are in the DNA, we can change the sequence of DNA, we can change any aspect of these proteins, and that's going to change the structure of the tools, of the machines, and of the factories, and of its function. So some genetic engineering tools. So we have something that people are talking a lot now about, and that's CRISPR-Cas9 system. And this is a non-homologous end-joining system. So basically, you have an enzyme that's going to cut somewhere in the middle of the string of the bases of DNA. And what happens is, it cuts it and it repairs it. We have a cell-based repair mechanism. So it'll cut it, it'll repair it, and then it'll cut it again, and it'll repair it again. And it'll just keep doing that until it makes a mistake, and that's called non-homologous end-joining. and it leaves out a few bases or it adds a few bases, then the CRISPR-Cas9 system doesn't recognize it anymore, so it doesn't cut it anymore. And so that's part of the reason it's so efficient. And it can result in changing just a handful of bases. With this technology, we can add genes, we can add a bunch of bases. We can get rid of genes, which is a knockout. We can take a specific domain, for example, and take it out or put more domains in. So we want that here no longer. Well, there's probably a domain in there that we can add that will give the same shape to make that gene longer. The swine genomes is about 3 million base pairs long. So one of the other things that we can do with this genetic engineering is add genes. And so this is a pig that we made that actually has a green fluorescent protein in it. So if you go into the aquarium and see jellyfish and they turn on the UV light, they fluoresce. Well, these pigs are green. And so you can see that when we turn off the lights, we turn on the fluorescence, and you can see the pigs are green. This is really pretty amazing. So now we're going to turn the lights back on, take the goggles off, and we're going to see pigs under just how they're moving normally. That's what the pigs look like, but they fluoresce. Then you say, why would you make such a pig? Actually, these are our most popular pigs. People want to use these cells for tracking studies. We have a group from Harvard that flies in and we collect fetal pig eyes. They culture out retinal progenitor cells, or cells that should be able to differentiate into rods and cones in the back of your eye. And then they take these cells and put them into a pig whose head is retina damaged. And 5 or 10 weeks later, they'll kill the pig, they pull out the eyes, they'll cut sections through that eye, and they'll look at it and they'll say, okay, this is the area we damaged, but it looks like it's repaired. They turn on the UV light, the cells fluoresce, and they say, ah, the cells that we transferred are the ones that facilitated the repair. So it's really pretty cool. So some of the timelines on this, well, if we're going to do genetic engineering of somatic cells, that might take a month. It might take a number of years. If we're going to design and build guides and use the CRISPR-Cas9 system, that takes a few days. The zygote injection of the somatic cell nuclear transfer, that's about a week. Gestation of pigs is, what, 3 weeks? 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days is probably a few more days than that. But puberty is 69 months, so you have about a year generation interval for pigs. So now let's transition over to porcine reproductive respiratory syndrome virus. The virus was first detected in 1987 and in Europe in 1990. Type 1 are the European strains, type 2 are the North American strains. This virus actually replicates in macrophages, alveolar macrophages, so that's white blood cells in the lungs. So alveolar macrophages, the alveoli of the lungs. And it produces this prolonged viremia, persistent infections last for months. It predisposes pigs to other infectious agents. Well, vaccines have been ineffective. They really don't work very well. Sows and gills, you're going to get reproductive failure, you're going to get early farrowing, decreased litter size, increased number of mummies. The boars, you have low libido, low sperm count. In growing in young pigs, this diarrhea and mortality is about 12-15%. When you look at the economic costs, in North America, it's estimated to be $664 million a year. In Europe, it's €1.5 billion. Guys, that's $6 million yesterday this disease cost. That's $6 million today this disease is going to cost in North America and Europe. And it's going to be $6 million again tomorrow. That doesn't even include Asia or Brazil or anywhere else in the world. So when we talk about the cost, so there's a financial cost, but there's a sustainability cost, because we can't, if we're going to be good stewards, we can't continue to put resources, time, feed, energy, whatever, into maintaining animals and producing animals that underperform. This is a threat to our food security, and it's an animal welfare issue. Nobody wants to see pigs get sick.
Cliff Lamb.
The other thing that people don't always appreciate is the psychological and emotional costs. When I talk to ag groups get it. So if you're a producer and your barn goes down, you're sitting at the kitchen table at night, and you're wondering, are we going to be able to pay our bills? Are we going to go bankrupt? Can we pay the loans that we already have? Are we going to be able to send the kids to college? Now, when I get to this point in the talk, and I see an audience out there, there's pig producers, sometimes the wife will tip her head to the side, reach out and grab her husband's shoulder, pull him up tight, and you almost, of course, the husband stares stoically ahead, but you almost see the tears, and when I see that in the audience, I know they know exactly what I'm talking about. And I think people that are opposed to some of these things look at animal agriculture as some faceless corporation and we don't care. But it's families, and that's what we need to sell this on. Okay, so how does PRRS infect the cell? Well, if we think that this blue, these blue things are plasmid membrane, there's some molecules that stick out. The first one is that heparin sulfate, another molecule is something called cyanoadhesin, and the third one is something called CD163. And all of these three molecules stick out of the plasmid membrane. Well, the model is that the PRRS virus under my bar. So the virus comes in and binds, has some loose association with heparin sulfate. It then binds to cyanoadhesin. It gets internalized into a vesicle. In that vesicle, the pH drops. And then the virus associates with CD163. And that then uncoats the viral genome. So the viral genome can be released into the cell and infect the cell. So that was the model that was proposed by Van Breeden in 2010. Well, once we have a model like this, we can test it. And so we were able to produce our first pigs that had cyanoadhesin knocked out, and the abbreviation for that is Siglec 1. And this plus minus means that they still had one good copy from one parent, but the other copy of it was knocked out. So we have a bunch of boys. So we had to produce some girls and then do some inbreeding. Be able to, some full set of babies to be able to get animals that had both alleles knocked out. So our first litter had four pigs that were minus minus, so these pigs had no cyanoadhesin sticking out on their cell surface. So in theory, if that's what the virus bound, it wouldn't bind anything. And the pigs wouldn't get infected. We had some pigs that were heterozygous, where they had one good copy and one knockout copy. And then we also had four animals that were wild type. So Mendel was very kind to us at this time. And just to get you to the end point, cyanoadhesin knockout is not embryonic lethal, and that's one of the questions you always have when you make a knockout. But unfortunately, it did not affect the susceptibility to PRRS. So if any of you guys had a use for these pigs, they're actually going real cheap right now. So the timeline for that project, we actually conceived the idea in June of 2002. We looked for money, and we finally got our founders board in 11. The paper was published in 13, 11 years later. This is the longest project I've ever worked on, but it set the proof of principle on our ability to test these things. So the other molecule I talked about was CD163, and there were a whole bunch of in vitro experiments that people did that were similar to the cyanoadhesin, the Siglec 1 projects, and provided evidence that CD163 was not... was an intermediary as well to facilitate infection. But people are still talking about other molecules that I have listed down here that it might be involved. So there's this paper that came out by Van Gorp where they took CD163 and it has these nine domains. So this is pig CD163 with the nine domains. Here we have human CD163. This next one is human CD163-like. And what they did was they swapped out domains. So here we have domain 1, 2, and 3 from pig, 7, 8, 9 from pig, but then they swapped in 7, 8, 9 from human CD163. Actually, they're numbered differently because they started the numbering up here rather than down here. But they're the same domain as domain 5. So when they swap those out, you see down here at the bottom, there's no infection. And this is an in vitro study. And basically, over here on the right, they showed that all you have to do is swap out domain 8, you can get rid of infection. So we tried a couple of different approaches. One, we tried some traditional homologous recombination, and then we also tried a domain swap, so we could make that exact same molecule and replace it with domain 8 from human CD163-like. Why did we want to just do that? Well, it's thought that domain 3 down here is thought to be involved with having hemoglobin clearance. Erythroblast binding was thought to be involved with domain 2, this tumor necrosis factor superfamily 12, thought to be binding 1 through 4 and 69. It's thought that bacteria might be scavengers by number 2. Again, number 5, we thought that might be the first one, but we also thought that number 2 might be the cure for African swine fever. And unfortunately, these pigs get sick just like wild type pigs. So we were incorrect in that assumption. So we tried to do this two different ways. One is we tried to edit fibroblast cells and then do some genetic cell nuclear transfer. And we also did the zygote injection on the CRISPR-Cas9 system. And so this is kind of what it looks like with the somatic cell nuclear transfer. Here you can see an unfertilized egg that they're getting ready to pull the chromosomes out of, and then they'll transfer back in the donor cell. And then we also do zygote injection. So these are, we go to the slaughterhouse, get ovaries, we bring them back, we get the eggs, we mature them, fertilize them, and then we do zygote injection. And it makes everybody happy. So this was our first targeting vector that we had. So this is a normal piece of DNA that's on the chromosome. We wanted to do this domain swap along with some selectable markers so we can identify it. And the bottom line is we screened over 3,000 colonies and we had nothing. It didn't work. We couldn't make it work. So then we started in with CRISPRs. The first time we used it, it worked. And this is kind of a diagram of what happens. It's here we have our piece of chromosome. And you can come up with a guide that's outlined here in blue. And you have some other sequence on here that will recognize the protein. And what happens is this blue region aligns with the chromosome, and then the protein associates with it and cuts it here, and it keeps cutting it until it repairs it incorrectly. So I just want to come down here and the timeline on this, because it's really pretty amazing. The timeline from the time we started it was 5.5 to 6 months. You look at the dates, we started in July of 13, and we had our pigs in January of 14. This is lightning speed for us. So, the timelines of gestation, in the case of CD163, is less than 6 months in the data we implemented. First time we tried this technology. So I want to talk first about a knockout animal, and then an animal that has wild-type CD163 on the cell surface. So think of these red circles as representing cells from two different pigs. You've got one pig that doesn't have any molecules sticking out on the cell surface, nothing for the virus to bind, versus a pig that has all nine domains. Can you tell which pigs are knockouts? No, because the pigs, they look perfectly normal. They behave perfectly normal. The pigs that we're really interested in this study were pigs number 43, 55, and 40. And we can focus in on number 40. We added seven bases, seven letters in the genome on the 3 million in one allele, and in the other allele, we pulled out 11 bases. So we have a net change of 18 bases that we changed. That results in no CD163 being produced by this animal. We shipped pigs to Kansas State. Bob Rowland there, their crew didn't know which pigs were which. They acclimated for 3 days. They challenged them with this relatively hot MBSL virus. The pigs were co-housed. They collected blood throughout the study, collected alveolar macrophages at the end, and did this test. Pathology of the lungs as well. So I dropped the pigs off and drove back to Columbia, and a few days later, Bob Rowland sends me this email, says, "Well, what were the results? Everyone busted their butts to get it done, but this one we got it right." And the technician says, "Yeah, we've never seen this before. Pigs 40, 43, and 55 are negative." So this is the data. These are the wild-type animals up here. If we look at respiratory signs, by day 7, 50% of the pigs had some sort of respiratory sign. About 50% of the pigs had fever. The null animals, those knockout animals, so CD163 minus minus bad, there's nothing here. These pigs didn't get respiratory. They're around the same end getting coughed down by these other pigs. There's no fever. Now, this is what K-State, Bob Rowland's group, usually sees with the virus response. So this is virus in the blood. Day 0, it's 0. By day 4, they have a huge amount. So this is a log. So there's a 1 and 6 zeros. So that's how much virus they detect. And then it tapers off as you proceed on. So they challenge over 3,000 pigs at Kansas State, and they always see a response like this. And when we challenged our pigs, well, our wild-type pigs came up just like they've seen before. Knockout pigs are down here in the bottom. There's no virus in the blood. So the pigs develop an antibody response after a while. Here's the wild-type pigs. They develop an antibody response. These pigs didn't develop an antibody response because they didn't get exposed to enough virus replicating in the body. These pigs, it's like they don't see the virus. It's like you getting infected by the virus. You don't. You walk in that thing, these pigs are coughing on each other, the wild types are getting sick. You don't, they don't. So now I want to shift gears and talk about the knockouts, the wild type, and then that domain swap that we made. So this is a little bit going to be, the first slide is going to be a little bit different, because what we did was take cells from these pigs that have these genotypes, and we infected them in vitro in the lab. And so here we have all the wild type pigs, and we use a number of type 1, type 2 viruses. So type 1 up here, type 2 down here. So North American and European strains. And so with the wild type pigs, we're getting 50 to 60% of the cells actually getting infected. With the knockout pigs, neither virus is infecting the pigs at all. So what's really interesting is when we look at the wild type or the main swap pigs, like the group in the Netherlands and Belgium found, they didn't get any infection when they used type 1 or European strain. Well, we also infected those pigs with North American strains. And look, we're getting anywhere from, 3 to 12% of the cells getting infected. So the question is, because that small percentage of the cells got infected, does that make a sick pig? The answer is it does. So when we look at, again, type 1, so this is the European strain, wild type, they get infected just fine. The knockout animals are down here. There's no virus in the blood. And then the main swap animals are down here in the squares. There's no virus in the blood. When we look at the type 2, so this is going to be North American strains, the wild-type animals, they get infected. And actually, the squares show the main swap, they get infected. This was a single animal. It was kind of an outlier. I'm not sure how to explain that. But again, the knockout animals, there's nobody who can get infected at all. We've also done some studies, we're getting a little short on time. So we also did some studies looking at reproductive birds. And basically, the answer is, if you have an animal that is CD163-, even though she has piglets in her fetuses that are susceptible, they don't get infected. So our overall conclusions is silohesin knockout pigs are not resistant to PRRS. CD163 pigs are resistant to both type 1 and type 2. An animal that's a knockout can protect her fetus. And we know that domain 5 of CD163 is a contributor to infection, and it may be different from type 1 and type 2 viruses. So we had this model that we started with, and now we know that, well, that's probably not involved. That's probably not involved. But CD163, yeah, that's involved. And I really like that these guys put forward this model because it gave us something to test. It gave us something that we can now look at and try to figure out what molecules are involved, and we have the tools that we can answer that. So CD163 is a gatekeeper. So some of the questions I often get, and I'm going to try to address these here just at the end of the last about 6 slides. So are all non-gene knockouts bad? Well, some are embryonic lethal. Others are neonatal lethal. So a cystic fibrosis, if you don't treat that pig, it's going to die. We have pigs where we compromise their immune system, and that's going to result in animals that die if you don't do something. There's other genes that you can knock out or modify that are detrimental, and one is Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. This is actually the gene responsible for PKU or phenylketonuria. And this is the ABC gene. This gives polyps in the intestine. And so the pigs can look fine depending on which mutation it is, but it is detrimental. Some knockouts will result in animals that are infertile. There's a whole bunch of them that we've made, and others that I can't talk about. There's no general impact. So you knock out these genes, these pigs look fine. They behave fine. They produce fine. They reproduce fine. Really doesn't seem to affect them. So edits in production agriculture. Again, we're talking about a 3 billion base pair genome, letters of the genome. We all talk about 18, and now they're not safe to eat, and the AS rate of them really. So disease resistance, we talked about CD163. There's a group in Roslyn that has taken the RLA gene from the warthog and put it in domestic pigs and they've changed that to 3 or 4 amino acids, and they're hopeful that these pigs will be resistant to African swine fever. Something more important to you guys is Manhania hemolytica, and that's contributes to bovine respiratory disease. We can change a single amino acid in that, and the animal should be resistant to bovine respiratory disease. A single amino acid, maybe 3 letters of the genome to change. Why can't we eat those without being regulated? We've also made mutations to study influenza, and actually this was Jürgen Rieck, also there at Kansas State University. We knocked out CD1D to study a specific type of T cell in the pig. What about some animal welfare issues? Whole dairy cattle, I'm sure you guys have heard of this, we can introgress this Celtic version of the whole gene into the Holsteins, and they don't have horns. There's the animal welfare issue here. We need to have the freedom to address these animal welfare issues. But what about productivity? There's examples there. I'm not going to go into them now. What about altering the composition of the carcass? So we have our omega-3 pigs, and this is a tranche. So it's a little bit different. So this is allowing us to answer really some interesting basic and applied questions about human medicine and domestic animal biology. So where do we go from here? Well, with CB-163, we're going to have to show that there are no unintended consequences. Do these animals really stay healthy? Well, so far they have. Do they really grow the same? They grow fine. We have done our growth study. Is there feed deficiency the same? We don't know those. And we're going to have to have that. So I think for you guys to think about your problems, what problem is in the industry that could be alleviated should we change the animal a little bit. So what might the solution look like? What are you doing in your day-to-day routine that I wish I didn't have to do this? If there's a biological answer out there, we can probably address it and make that genetically engineered animal, whether it's an edit, small edit, and knock out a gene, or whether it's changing a few amino acids, or adding transgenes or getting rid of segments of chromosomes. The real question is, will the public accept the solution? And for basic science, I think that's really important. We can go ahead and go forward with a lot of these genetic modifications. But when it comes to the application, we're going to have to deal with that. So there's a whole lot of people that have helped with these projects. I want to point out Kristen Whitworth at Kemper Wells because they're really an important part of this team and this major genetic modifications organizing. But, you know, we've had a couple different groups of people sitting in plant manipulators doing the zygote injections and doing transfer. We've got different people taking care of pigs. John Green and his group really helped out with the silo-easy project. The crew at Kansas State, wow, this has been so great to be able to go back and at home and work with these guys. Genus has helped us out. They really helped us carry the ball over the goal line. We had it kind of started with Christopher Plum's money. We had some ARS pork money down here. Well, not pork, eating pork, but pork money. And so we had those things. So that's where I'd like to end up, and I'd be more than happy to take any questions. Thank you so much for bearing with me over the internet.